This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Great Lakes water expert joins us for a look at laws protecting the lakes as two major diversion projects are in the works for Waukesha and in Joliet, Illinois. Now, June 5th, this coming Monday, is the debt ceiling deadline. That's the date that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said the U.S. will no longer be able to cover all of its financial obligations. In other words, the country would be unable to pay all the money it owes. A federal debt default could have a number of pretty heavy consequences, hurting America's credit rating, setting off economic turmoil domestically and potentially around the world, unless Congress is able to raise the national borrowing limit, also known as the debt ceiling. Over the weekend, President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy finally struck a deal over the debt ceiling bill. The House is working to vote on it this evening. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been worried about the default scenario we've been hearing about? What questions do you have about what's in this deal, this bill that would raise the debt ceiling limit? Have you followed the negotiations? Are there other outcomes you would like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Ginger Gibson is senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back. Glad to be here.
Well, this deal from over the weekend was a long time in the making. Can you recap some of the highlights of what it took to get to where we are today?
Yeah, there were moments where we wondered if we were ever going to get to today when the House is going to vote. They've cleared, they're clearing a rule now, and they were expected to vote tonight, but this goes back months. We can look back to last year when House Republicans won control of the chamber, and we knew this was a thing they needed to do this year. And then we can look to January, when McCarthy won the speakership and what was a really fraught process. Took him 13 ballots to get there, and this was looming ahead as sort of the big test that he was going to face after he secured that. And then we saw one brief conversation between the president and McCarthy in January where they brought up the debt ceiling, and then nothing, as McCarthy likes to point out, 97 days of which they did not talk about the debt ceiling until we got to this month. And it seemed to then be crunch time. It became apparent that June was the deadline, that they needed to get something done by early June. And the House was able to pass a bill. So we saw the House surprise, sort of defy expectations and get a piece of legislation through that would raise the debt ceiling and sort of do all the things Republicans thought they should get in exchange for raising the debt ceiling: cut spending, get rid of some programs, approve permitting reform, a bunch of different things that they wanted done. And that's really what kicked off the negotiations. And we've been watching weeks of these negotiations behind closed doors. And for those of us that have been in Washington for a while, I've been here over a decade, really just quiet closed door. They weren't leaking. They weren't coming out and telling people what either side said. They're really hashing it out behind closed doors until Saturday night when they came out and said, all right, they have a deal. And so this long process over days and weeks to get an agreement that now it looks like optimistically for them is going to pass through Congress.
Now, our starting point to get here in some ways was President Biden said, hey, this is the debt ceiling. It shouldn't be negotiating leverage for the budget. We'll do that with the budget later this year. So, no, we shouldn't be making a deal at all. Republicans passing that bill you mentioned, which says we should use the debt ceiling as leverage to do a lot of things we want to do that we think we were elected to do with the House. Where did we end up? What are some of the highlights of the deal they ended up reaching somewhere between those two points?
That's right. If you go back and you ask the White House even today, are they negotiating on the debt ceiling? The answer would be no. They would say they're negotiating over spending separately. A parallel track was one of their ways they like to describe it. But it is, in fact, a negotiation to get this debt ceiling bill passed. And what the deal does is it caps spending. So it's going to freeze spending essentially over the next 2 years in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. And it will allow some other key pieces of legislation that they wanted to see passed. So we're talking about permitting reform is a big thing that they have been discussing, getting to an agreement that allows, and permitting reform sounds like, a term that doesn't really clear what it means, but it would allow some energy projects to move more quickly through Congress. So permitting reform is a piece of it. Extends the debt limit to 2023. 25. And then it allows for, it stops or doesn't allow for the president to extend the student loan borrowing freeze that has been in place. So it stops some of those pieces from moving forward, which was already sort of the plan the president had in terms of ending the freeze on student loan payments.
You mentioned extending the debt ceiling to 2025. It's 2023 right now, and well, right between those is the 2024 election. Is that an important factor in why this goes into 2025 so we don't have to deal with this before the election?
Absolutely. I think that if you're any member of Congress and you're watching, or the president, and you're watching this all play out, the last thing you want to do is probably repeat this, at least if you're Kevin McCarthy or Joe Biden, in the fall of next year or the summer of next year, when you're looking days, weeks away from a presidential election. The sort of partisanship gets really cranked up in Washington in an election year. Sure, it would maybe provide a bit more leverage to some sides. So maybe some rank and file members of the House see it doing it again next year as an opportunity to extract more concessions from the White House. But these things are much more difficult if you try to do them in an election year. And so, absolutely, it was a factor in these negotiations, getting clear of that election. And then they can also say to their voters, this is what I did, this is what I argued, send me back to do it again, whether you're Biden or House Republicans. This is something they can talk about to voters when they go out and campaign.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital, talking about the debt ceiling deal reached between President Biden, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, now going to votes in the House, probably this evening. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Christine joins us now in Eau Claire. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for letting me onto the program. Frankly, as an independent, I'm really frustrated that the news media hasn't done a better job of letting the U.S. Americans know that it's really the Republicans that are being the jerks in this situation. I know that the Democrats had a chance before they lost the House to address this, but Biden gave them the House a budget on March 9th, and McCarthy has been stalling and lying and stalling and lying, and it's just there are 40 million people in America who are impoverished, and Congress is doing nothing except whatever negotiations are going to affect people who are poor or working class.
Christine, thanks a lot for the call. First of all, Ginger, Christine, putting the blame here on the Republicans over the tightness of this deadline on the debt ceiling.
Well, it's absolutely true that the Republicans are the ones who saw that this offered them leverage. I think there would be a lot of different opinions, and that's one take about whether or not it was a good thing that they used that leverage. Republicans, conservatives say they should have used more leverage. Democrats wanted to raise the debt ceiling. They should have used all they could to get out even more concessions, more cuts to government funding, more cuts to government programs, that this is the only way they could get something done. Critics, Democrats, probably some independents, like the caller now, would say that this is not an item you should have been taking leverage on, that raising the debt limit isn't authorizing new spending, that this is spending that's already been approved, and that it would be wrong to use this as leverage, that you're risking the economy, people who could lose their jobs if we saw a recession. And then I think we're also going to hear a lot of criticism from Democrats. We've seen Democrats who have said they aren't going to vote for this deal, even though it was negotiated by the president, including folks like Bernie Sanders, who announced today he wasn't going to vote for the bill, who are upset that it could make cuts to some government programs, particularly food stamps. It has a work requirement that would require more people work more hours. In order to be eligible for food stamps. And they've long argued, particularly in states that have implemented similar programs, these programs do nothing to help people, but instead take assistance away from sick people, from disabled people, from people who are maybe suffering from drug addictions, and rely on these programs in order to have something to eat.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the debt ceiling and the race in Congress to pass a bill that raises that ceiling before the country, in theory, defaults on its debts starting as soon as next week. Ginger Gibson stays with us, senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What do you think about the politics at play here, the policies you're hearing about in this conversation. Ultimately, do you want your Wisconsin, a member of Congress, your senators to vote for this debt ceiling extension? Why or why not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ginger Gibson, senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital. We're talking about the bill in Congress to raise the national debt limit. The U.S. House is expected to vote on that tonight. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about what's in this deal and why it's there and what you want to happen. If you want the Wisconsin congressional delegation to support this deal or try to block it, join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ginger, you mentioned some Republicans in the House not happy with the deal. They wanted to get more out of the debt ceiling leverage. This is tied up in how Speaker Kevin McCarthy became Speaker Kevin McCarthy in the first place. Can you talk about how that all ties together?
That's right. We all remember back in January, although it does at times feel like an eon ago, Kevin McCarthy had a really hard time becoming Speaker. It took 13 ballots to get him there. And part of the concern that the real hardliners in his caucus had, even at the time, was what was going to happen when the debt ceiling had to be raised. They wanted promises from McCarthy that he would extract concessions from the administration. So he was making promises to his members in the process of getting elected speaker that he would go hard in these negotiations and that he would produce results for them. And there was always this explicit threat that if he didn't, his job would be terminated. He also agreed at that time to allow the return of what's known as the motion to vacate, which says that any member of the House can stand up on the floor and make a motion to kick the speaker out of that job. That had been removed in an effort to keep sort of small revolts by just little parts of the caucus from happening. He allowed it to come back. I mean, right now, at this point, at 4:40, on Wednesday, it doesn't look like there will be a motion to vacate over this debt ceiling, and it looks like he will weather the storm. But I've learned in Washington to never predict the future. It remains a daily possibility for him, especially as we see a number of Republicans not voting on the procedural motion just now that passed and then have said they won't vote on the bill tonight.
So we got another caller now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I think that it's mostly political posturing on both sides, really. If there's anybody serious about getting rid of or reducing the debt, Social Security, defense spending, Medicare, Medicaid all have to be in the conversation, and nobody's willing to do that. So if they're serious, they might look at a national sales tax dedicated to debt reduction only. And then they could, you know, we didn't get in this hole overnight, and it's and we aren't going to get out of it. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. Ginger, Jimmy does a great job of summing up things that are not on the table, never really were on the table in this debt conversation. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, military spending, and increasing taxes. And I think it's hard to reduce the deficit and bring down the overall debt without looking at least some of those things.
That's right. I mean, you look at something like Jimmy pointed out this a national sales tax. That's a non-starter for both sides. Sales tax tax as a portion of income poorer people more than wealthy people. Think about it. If we both go buy a loaf of bread and pay a dollar in taxes and I make $100 a week and you make $1,000 a week, I paid more of my income in taxes than the wealthy person, would be the argument Democrats would make against a sales tax. And Republicans are just anti-taxes. So they're not going to approve any new taxes at all. They think we have too many taxes. And that even for something like debt reduction, we shouldn't have more taxes. So I think those were non-starters. Lowering the deficit have been really an issue that a lot of people talk about, but has not been really tackled. We did see McCarthy today talking about a blue ribbon panel or some type of panel to mitigate deficit reduction. action. That was something he waved off a number of months ago, now seems to be back as an option. And I think it's because finding a solution that is sustainable, I think, is the other piece, right? You might get some type of debt reduction in place, some type of idea of debt reduction in place, and our government changes hands. And so 2, 4, 6 years later, a different party's in charge and they undo the plan the other side had to reduce the deficit. So I do think that it's a very complicated long-term problem, and no one thus far has seemed to come up with a way that they think would address it over the long haul.
Thanks a lot for that call. Go to Marlene now in Marshfield. Marlene, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Marlene?
Well, I just, I'm concerned. I supervise a team of people for a charitable organization. We assist people who are elderly and disabled. And this whole conversation is putting many people who on a horrific edge. They, you know, live on Social Security or food stamps. They're unable to live independently without that sort of assistance. A lot of very elderly people. And I think this is torturous, and this playing this game of let's crash the system, you know, kind of teasing is cruel, and that it should really be resolved in a different manner than it presently is. Yes, spending should not continue, but it should not be that, yes, when our team is in the favor, we can do this. And when your team, we're going to hold our breath and have daily announcements on television that have a lot of people very concerned about even staying housed. I think it's cruel and should somehow find some other way to address that.
Marlene, thanks a lot for that call. A couple ways I want to look at that, Ginger. First of all, the notion that if we didn't end up with a debt ceiling increase, there has been concern that the people that Marlene is talking about, people receiving Social Security or food stamps, well, they might be on the list of things that government wouldn't be able to pay. Is that a concern if the debt ceiling isn't raised?
I think that is a concern, and I would take it one step further. I mean, I think that there's a discussion being had in Washington about whether there should be a debt ceiling at all. One sort of thread through all of this debate and discussion was whether the White House could invoke the 14th Amendment, as it was being said, which says in it that the debts of the United States should not be questioned. There has been a lot of legal arguments that that means that there shouldn't even be a debt ceiling, that there's the Constitution says that they can't be questioned, that they could just raise that debt, you know, amount as Treasury saw fit. There is a real possibility that we could see the president, after this is resolved, try to do away with the debt ceiling forever. Forget 2 years, try through the end of time. The president has acknowledged a number of times that that option was going to require a lot of legal litigation, that he thought the courts would get involved and there would be a question about whether or not it was constitutional. And that made it really not a practical option in the moment right now, because they would default before they could answer those questions. But I wouldn't rule it out. People who argue that, you know, playing with the debt ceiling, running into questions about whether or not someone's Social Security check or a veteran's disability check is going to show up next week really is a reason to just do away with the whole thing, that we're the United States and that nobody else in the developed world has a debt ceiling and that we should just get rid of it. In fact, maybe we already did the 14th Amendment and we should just acknowledge it.
Thanks for that call, Marlene. And then zooming in on this deal, you mentioned earlier, Ginger, this idea of work requirements for people receiving food assistance and other forms of assistance. More work requirements for some people up to age 55. But for some people, I believe, including veterans, the requirements would actually be loosened so that the deal might not affect the people Marlene's working with so much. Do I have that right?
That's right. So there are some changes. In fact, the Congressional Budgeting Office came out last night and said, actually, maybe those changes would result in more people being eligible for food stamps and it costing the government more, not less, and it isn't a savings. We had a story a couple weeks ago looking at some of those changes, not all of them, but some similar versions that have been enacted in states. Places like Arkansas have done some similar things. And figuring out the effects is really complicated because some people think they've lost their benefits and they haven't, or they don't know how to apply for exemptions because they hear they're supposed to work now and they're not, or they can't, and they just say, well, I guess I don't know how to navigate the bureaucracy of an exemption. That means I don't get any more benefits. So I think we're going to see people paying close attention to whether or not this affects disabled veterans. This affects people who are really incapable of working, who might not be able to figure out the paperwork that's going to take for them to keep their benefits.
Ginger, I want to take our last minute and a half or so to look at what's next. As you mentioned, some rules hurdles being cleared now. Vote expected tonight. If the House does pass this, and it seems like it's leaning that way, what's the timeline from here on out?
That's right. So they passed this vote, this rules vote, just as I was getting on the air with you. So that's done. And that's normally a pretty good indication that they're going to have the votes to pass it, we think, after 8 o'clock tonight. And then next it goes to the Senate. And at first we saw some threatening from some senators that they might try to block it or delay the bill because they were unhappy with it. And they sort of backed down, Senator Lee saying they're going to let him have a vote on an amendment and that will get him on board and he won't try to block it or delay things. So could happen on Friday, could happen on Saturday, could happen on Sunday, but it looks like the Senate is on track once the likeliness that the House sends it over to them this evening.
And just our last minute now, Ginger, if the House for some reason votes it down tonight or doesn't end up with the vote, well, then what?
Well, I would not look at your 401k in the morning if the House votes this down, but there will definitely be a scramble. There will be a lot of scrambling on the Hill to figure out what they need to do to get the votes and whether or not Democrats and Republicans could figure out a new path forward. I would just stay off your 401k website until they figure it out. That would be my suggestion.
Ginger, we'll leave it there. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ginger Gibson, senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital. She joined us for a look at the latest on this bill in Congress aimed at raising the debt ceiling. Keep following the news. You can listen here, of course, on the Ideas Network. Watch WPR.org for ongoing reporting from our friends at NPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, most mask rules have gone away in the United States, but how about in healthcare settings? Kate and her guests look at calls for universal masking in hospitals and clinics. And of course, you can weigh in and you can do it right now, ideas@WPR.org. If you've been a patient in a healthcare setting or you work in one, what are you seeing around you when it comes to mask use? What do you wish you saw? What do you think the rules should be? Email ideas@WPR.org. Join the conversation tomorrow at 7. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at two major water diversion projects from Lake Michigan and how they fit in with wider regulations and conservation efforts for the Great Lakes. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a group of model train aficionados.
The oldest Lionel Railroad Club in the world is hiding inside a boxy commercial building in New Berlin, just outside Milwaukee. Jane Hampton discovered the club when she was ready to say goodbye to a special set of vintage Lionel trains.
When I was growing up, my grandparents' trains circled the Christmas tree in their Pennsylvania farmhouse. The engine was heavy, and it pulled four cars around a sturdy metal track. I would sit on the floor, run the trains too fast, watch them derail, and line them up again. After my grandparents died, I brought the trains to Wisconsin. My boys and I set them up a few times, but the old transformer would send up sparks, and I was afraid the Christmas tree would catch fire. So finally, I decided to donate the trains. The guys at the Milwaukee Lionel Train Club told me to load up my set and come on over. I walked through a nondescript back door and into a railroad wonderland. Three giant layouts run 17 trains at one time. They chug through mini villages and farms and cities. The club was founded in 1947 in a Milwaukee basement. Steve Smiley is president.
It started small and stayed small for many years in the basement. And then they got a garage and they moved into the basement of a church. This is our fourth layout.
Now the club has about 250 members. At the spring open house, I met dozens of visitors playing with the interactive layouts, including 9-year-old Elliot.
There's a Thomas train and there's a James train. You can press a direction button, a whistle button, and a bell button.
Are they gonna do the rocket ship yet?
Oh, you wanna do the rocket ship? Let's go do the rocket ship, all right?
turn on the beacon, push a button to start the countdown. This one here. Let's get ready. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, blast off. Whoa! What do you think, huh?
Good.
Ian Rogers from Milwaukee brought his kids, Elon and Jabril.
Well, their grandfather, who just recently passed, unfortunately, was a lover of trains. And so he actually built them down in the basement, built them from scratch, and we'll put them all together and for them to be able to see the cities and all that good stuff. And so they were missing them kind of through the week. And we saw the open house and we said, pew, we're on our way.
Rebecca Johnson drove her kids over from Madison.
My oldest is almost 4 and he's almost 2 and they're both just like blown away by everything.
There's Percy.
Years ago, the 20s through the 60s, everything in the country was rail.
Josh Albers is from Waukesha. He builds layouts at home for his grandson, Elijah.
Every kid had trains back when I was growing up. And I'm just trying to pass that along to my grandson.
I asked Steve Smiley about the trains my grandparents passed down to me. Turns out they were from the 1932 Lionel catalog and would have cost $17 back then.
So this is a 262 steam engine. I happen to have one. And they run great. The gondola would be what you hauled along. You know, we used to put our hamster in them and haul them around the railroad tracks. The boxcar, you know, had to go along. And, of course, the caboose.
So if I tried to sell this on eBay instead of coming here, what would I have gotten for it?
Well, for a 262 steam engine and tender, you'd probably get about $150 for it. Now, if it was in brand new box and it was pristine, which it probably wasn't, but if it was, you could get as much as $500 for it.
It was not in a brand new box and it was not pristine, but the old set has found a joyful new home.
A choo-choo train!
Jane Hampton brought us that story on the Lionel Railroad Club. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the city of Chicago recently agreed to a billion-dollar deal to sell Lake Michigan water to the city of Joliet, Illinois, and its surrounding suburbs starting in 2030. It's part of a special exception Illinois has in the Great Lakes Compact that governs the use of the Great Lakes water. The deal comes as construction begins on a different diversion project that was years in the making in Waukesha. A water pipeline will bring Lake Michigan water to the city. The treated wastewater will return to the lake through the Root River. That project is scheduled to be completed by the start of September after it was first approved in 2016. The two diversions are the latest prominent examples in the fight over how Great Lakes water is used, as conservation remains a priority for many communities in the region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Great Lakes water should be regulated? What questions do you have about these water diversion projects? Do you like the Great Lakes Compact the way it's structured now? Would you like to see changes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peter Annan is director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College in Ashland. He's the author of the book, The Great Lakes Water Wars. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be with you.
Well, I talked to you about this a lot as the Waukesha diversion project made it through various channels. But can you refresh us, big picture, what does the Great Lakes Compact do?
Yeah, the Great Lakes Compact can surely be viewed as a legal water fence designed to keep water inside the Great Lakes watershed or the Great Lakes Basin. And there are limited exceptions to that, but it's essentially a ban on diversions, except for limited exceptions like the Waukesha diversion that you just talked about.
Yeah, once in a great while, we hear ideas like, hey, could we water the southwestern part of the United States with Great Lakes water or things like that? The Great Lakes Compact, I think, was done with those sort of wild schemes in mind to make sure that it didn't go far away. Was that the main point of the compact?
Absolutely right. Yeah, no, it was quite, you know, forward looking, because here we are today with Lake Mead and Lake Powell, the two massive reservoirs on the Colorado River, have been over the last several years, you know, repeatedly breaking all time low water level records. 40 million people in the Southwest are stressing out about their long-term water supplies, and the atmospheric rivers that we've seen in the Southwest this last year are not nearly enough. And, you know, we would need years and years of precipitation like that to get back to the levels that were in those reservoirs in, say, 2000.
Now, this Waukesha diversion, you know, Waukesha, the scope of things, not crazy far from Lake Michigan, and it took a long time to get their diversion approved. Can you talk about the whole straddling county concept and how it factored into Waukesha potentially being able to get this water, but having to jump through a lot of hoops to get there?
Yeah, I mean, it's really complicated, but to try and make it super simple, the compact had envisioned these unique communities like New Berlin, which in suburban Milwaukee sits right on top of the Great Lakes watershed line. And so it would be impossible to send water from one side of town to the other without an exception to the Great Lakes Compact. And so before Waukesha, we had New Berlin, which was a straddling community exception, allowing them to send water from one end of town to the other, Great Lakes water specifically. Then Waukesha steps forward with the so-called straddling county exception, with a community that is not on the boundary, but is in a county that straddled the boundary. A community like Waukesha can request a Great Lakes water diversion, but that diversion requires the approval of all 8 Great Lakes governors. And that's a much higher bar. That's why it took such a long time. The application process is quite arduous, and it just stretched on and on and on for many, many years. And then in 2000, I actually can't remember at the moment what the year was that Waukesha actually finally, I think it was 2016, finally got that approval. And that diversion of 8 million gallons is due to come online this summer.
Talking to Peter Annan, author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, talking about diversions from the Great Lakes. Who can use that water, who can't, and when? You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were part of that Waukesha story, you're still watching it, join in at 800-642-1234. Peter, I thought I got the gist of the Great Lakes Compact, but I'm finding out with this Joliet diversion, Great Lakes Compact, asterisk, does not necessarily apply in Illinois. What is different about Illinois?
Yeah, well, it's water's complicated, and the Great Lakes Compact really sort of signifies that. But then long before the compact, we have the Chicago River reversal in 1900. You know, why is this here? You got the giant stockyards in the late 1800s in Chicago, and they're dumping all this filth in the Chicago River. Anecdotal evidence of the river running red with blood being washed out of these slaughterhouses into the river, and then a giant sewage slick documented way out into Lake Michigan, getting close to the city of Chicago's water intake structures miles offshore. So the city was very concerned that its unsustainable water practices were going to create a major health crisis, and there were major outbreaks of illnesses because of their water management practices. So it embarks on this multi-year effort to dig a 28-mile canal in the upper reaches of the Chicago River, lower that grade in the upper reaches of the river, and reverse the flow so that sewage that was flowing out into Lake Michigan would actually go the other way into the Des Plaines River, into the Illinois River, and ultimately the Mississippi River. So Chicago's plan was to flush its sewage to St. Louis. Not popular in Missouri, which challenged the case in court and lost. And then the Chicago diversion continued to roll along for many, many years until the state of Wisconsin and several other states, the Supreme Court cases, Wisconsin et al. Versus Illinois, challenges this Chicago diversion in court. And for decades, these states are suing each other very controversially. In 1967, we have the latest iteration of the Supreme Court's decision, capping the Illinois diversion, the Chicago diversion, at 2.1 billion gallons per day. So every day, 2.1 billion gallons of Lake Michigan water flow to the Gulf of Mexico through metropolitan Chicago. That one diversion has lowered water levels on Lakes Michigan and Huron by 2.5 inches. Doesn't sound like a lot, but if we were to replicate that you know, half a dozen times, we're talking about feet, and feet do matter on the Great Lakes. And so that's why the Great Lakes Compact was formed, to prevent something like this from ever happening again. Well, in the negotiations, there was the most tense moment was what to do about the Illinois diversion, the Chicago diversion, whether to grandfather it, whether to, you know, whatever. And in the end, Illinois refused to do anything other than the status quo. And so the states were in a position where, do they go forward and have a compact that doesn't include Illinois, which is the home to the largest diversion in the Great Lakes region, or do they include Illinois and make it, you know, 8 happy campers in the Great Lakes basin, and then so that's what they ended up doing. And so what we have is Illinois has this really gaping exception in the Great Lakes Compact, and under the Supreme Court decree, the Supreme Court didn't want to micromanage it. They allow Illinois to send the water anywhere in the state, far beyond where Waukesha is, far beyond any straddling community or straddling county. And so over the last several years, Illinois has been slowly giving water away to the collar communities, most of which are outside the Great Lakes watershed. And then we have this Joliet decision recently that is much farther away still, and it's captured a lot of attention because it's much farther away from the lake than Waukesha is, for example. So complicated. Hopefully I boiled it down without losing you, Rob.
I think I'm following you, Peter. We're talking to Great Lakes water expert Peter Annan from Northland College in Ashland, looking at Lake Michigan water diversion projects, one in the works in Waukesha, and now this new one on the way in Joliet, Illinois, and how the water is regulated around the region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for what people can and can't do with Great Lakes water, Peter is the person who has a good shot at answering it. Make a call now at 800-642-1234. If you live in Waukesha or nearby, are you happy to see this diversion project in the works? Or did you oppose that project? What about this Joliet deal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Peter Annan from Northland College. He's the author of the book, The Great Lakes Water Wars, and he's with us today for a look at two Lake Michigan water diversion projects, one under construction, bringing water to Waukesha here in Wisconsin, and then Joliet, Illinois, where there's a plan to bring water from Lake Michigan there outside the Great Lakes watershed, and more generally about how Great Lakes water is used and conserved. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Peter, 100 years ago, maybe people could have asked, hey, could we maybe not empty our slaughterhouses into the Chicago River? Now with this Joliet thing, some conservation people are saying, well, wait a minute, could Joliet and the surrounding area do a better job of using the water resources they have instead of tapping in to Lake Michigan? Do you have thoughts on that argument?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a lesson in water sustainability. We live in one of the water richest regions of the world here in the Great Lakes region. But as it turns out, Joliet is a groundwater mess. They have one of the most severe cones of depression, they're called, where their groundwater has been so over withdrawn. It's one of the most severe in the Great Lakes region, if not the country. And it really is a lesson that even though we live in a water abundant part of the world, we still have to conserve, we still have to plan ahead. And so what happened is that Joliet kind of did an analysis, figured out only had about 10 more years of water left, and they need to find a new supply by 2030. They shopped around and they were able to negotiate this deal with the city of Chicago. But it still is a really important reminder to all of us that water is precious. It needs to be conserved, and that a long-term water supply plan is a crucial foundation to the environment and the economy and society for any community. And really, this situation should have been curbed by Joliet a long time ago.
How big an impact, if any, would diverting this water to Joliet have? If it's using, you know, Illinois' allotment of that number of gallons per day, does it actually increase withdrawals from the lake?
Yeah, it's a good question. It doesn't increase the withdrawal from the lake. Where Chicago is right now is that because of declines in heavy industry, steel industry, and things like that, it's sort of comfortably under this 2.1 billion gallon per day cap. And so that has allowed it to consider doing things like diverting all the way to Joliet. For sort of the water geeks in the Great Lakes region, however, there's kind of a warning here for long-term planning. So this is a 100-year deal with Joliet. And that means that in 100 years, this could be renegotiated again. But if Chicago, of course, is continuing to grow, if it starts to bump up in the future to that 2.1 billion gallons per day, in part because of deals like this with Joliet, if it were to go back to the Supreme Court and try and raise that limit again, I think it would be a really, really ferocious Supreme Court case revival over this this Supreme Court decree that Illinois is currently operating under, because there'd be little sympathy around the Great Lakes region for Illinois to go back to the Supreme Court now, given the kinds of things that are happening with Joliet.
Let's bring on a caller. Tanya is with us in Stevens Point. Tanya, hello.
Hi. So I just have a little comment. So I've been, you know, back and forth from Arizona to Wisconsin. And the one thing I noticed down there, they do not have water savers on their showers or on their toilets. And when we had a sink and a vanity and a toilet replaced, they said they didn't even know what water savers were. And the water pressure is amazing down there. And I always thought, well, that seems silly that they have to pump all that water all the way to Arizona and then they didn't conserve it. So I think something like what's going on now, that should be in the bill saying, you know, if we're going to take our water, at least you could do is make sure you're not wasting it, you know, and try to get those measures put in place as well.
Tanya, thanks for the call. Peter, the water from the Great Lakes, again, not going as far as Arizona, but could those strings be attached to any even currently allowed diversion deals from the Great Lakes?
Yeah, so there's, first of all, just to make it clear, right, it's no longer possible, if it ever was, to divert water from the Great Lakes, thanks to the Great Lakes Compact. And what we have seen, though, because the Great Lakes are protected, water hawks in the Southwest, especially in the state of Arizona, are looking to divert water from the Missouri River or the Mississippi River. And so the Arizona legislature passed a resolution asking Congress to study diverting water from the Mississippi River. When Congress didn't act upon that, then the Arizona legislature passed legislation to divert to study diverting water from the Mississippi River. And so these kinds of issues have really drawn attention, as Tanya said, to water practices in the Southwest and how sustainable they are or aren't. And what we see is 80% of the water use in the Southwest, Colorado River water, primarily is going to agriculture. And so, believe it or not, dairy farms is the largest commodity in Arizona. And so there's just a lot of really important questions being asked about water behavior in Arizona, since it's looking to far-flung diversions to possibly relieve their current water situation, which is very, very serious.
Tanya, thanks for the call. And Peter, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks, Rob.
That's Peter Annan, director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College in Ashland. He's the author of the book, The Great Lakes Water Wars. He's with us today to explain how Great Lakes water is regulated, with two diversion projects in the works in Waukesha and a new deal for Joliet, Illinois. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, if you want to repair your phone or your tractor, you may have to go to the company that made it. Find out how technology can make it harder for us to own our own stuff and why the Right to Repair movement wants to change things. Plus, wages for working-class Americans stagnated for 50 years. The author of the new book, Hell to Pay, says that was the result of intentional decisions by business and political leaders. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.